Questions? Okay, so, yes.
It seems kind of hidden, but was there a difference, at least for the mathematical problem? There must have been a big difference between the what we were supposed to do and what you gave us.
No, there's very little difference. It's mostly just copying and pasting what I had into Mathematica.
Okay. Yeah, I was nervous.
So I think that's a good way to get started on Mathematica. And so you can kind of see some of the problems. In particular, this nasty one of the conditional relations, which is going to happen basically all the time when you have Mathematica do an integral for you. And I did want you to see kind of how you would do those contour plots. I think are descriptive. They show you kind of how the voltage works. And you'd never want to do that by hand. So I thought you should see how to do it with Mathematica.
Excellent.
Yes. So copy and pasting that out, printing out the hard copy, putting those commands in a file, 100%.
All right.
More questions? Okay, so.
Hey, how's your leg?
Well, so they shot a lot of stuff in my back so that it's
numb.
Better. Yeah, so instead of being painful, it's numb, which is an improvement.
Yeah, I guess. So did they figure out what's wrong with you?
Well, so the fact that it improved says that the diagnosis that it's the insulation on my nerve is probably correct. So. Say again?
Does that doctor get a prize?
Does he get a prize? Oh, out of the three.
Well. Yeah, what do they do to that?
So they can keep shooting stuff in, and then they can dig into your backbone, which, you know, is not.
Dig in.
Not your favorite thing to be fussing with. So that's kind of the ultimate cure. So it's a matter of how, when the injections have to happen frequently enough that it becomes obnoxious, then they start cutting you open.
Okay.
And of course, the bad thing is if they make the bad cut, then you don't have the leg anymore at all.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, nerves kind of the whole thing. Okay, so enough about nerve conduction. So we've been dealing with electric fields for a while. And what we started out saying was that if you tell me what the charge density is, I can tell you what the electric field is. And that was just an integral. And what was a little bit new last time is we discovered that if we did these kind of simple processes, take the gradient, take the divergence, we got things that looked a whole lot like the electric field. So we could write the formula that we had for the E integral as the gradient of something instead. And what we got is exactly this result, which means that instead of doing three integrals for x, y, and z, we can just do one integral to get the voltage. The voltage is usually pretty descriptive and measurable, so in some sense it's more important than the electric field. But if you really wanted the electric field, quote unquote, all you would have to do would be to take the gradient of it anyway. So not all that huge a thing. So we can go from the voltage to the electric field just by taking the gradient. We can go from the electric field to the voltage just by doing this sort of integral. And every place we have dq, it might be a volume charge, it might be a surface charge, it might be a linear charge, it might be a series of points. We ought to be able to think about all of those things, maybe even all of them simultaneously present. And all it means is that we'd have to add up all the equivalent terms. Okay, questions on that? So in the past, we talked about this Kronecker delta. And the Kronecker delta has the property that for the two indices I and j, it's mostly equal to 0. But if I equals j, then it's equal to 1. And what the famous dead physicist Dirac came up with is something that's kind of the same thing, but for continuous indices. So instead of having integers 1, 2, 3, we have x's. And what the Dirac delta function is it's mostly 0 as long as x doesn't equal x prime, but the area under it is equal to 1. Okay, so the mathematicians aren't particularly happy with this. They would call it a distribution as opposed to a function. So here's the x-axis, and the delta function is 0 except for one point. And the area under that one point must get so big that the area under that point is still equal to 1. So it's kind of hard to imagine. So what's kind of an example of the Dirac delta function? Well, let's think about what's sometimes called the Heaviside function, or I'll usually call it the theta function. The theta function is a particularly simple function. It's a function that's equal to 0 when its argument is negative, and it's equal to plus 1 when its argument is positive. Okay, so pretty simple function. Theta of 0.1 is 1. Theta of minus 0.1 is 0. Don't ask me what theta of 0 is. So let's think about what the derivative of the theta function is. So first of all, the derivative of the theta function is mostly 0, right? Because derivative of flat is 0, derivative of flat is 0. Don't ask me what the value of theta prime is at the origin. But let's think about what the integral of theta prime is. So if I integrate, let's see if I got a better black pen. If I integrate theta over any small region, so say from a little bit before the origin to a little bit after the origin, then the fundamental theorem of calculus says that the value of the integral of the derivative is the function evaluated between endpoints. And of course, if we're in the positive point, then theta is going to equal 1, and if we're at the negative point, it's going to equal 0. So the area under theta prime is equal to 1. Okay, so this is kind of an easy example of what a delta function is like. Mostly 0. It has to be hugely infinite at the singular point, and the area under it is 1. So just like the derivative of the theta function, or the Heaviside function. Okay, so this is all in one dimension, and really what we want is something that is going to represent the charge density of something like an electron. So what we really want is something that when I integrate it over volume, I get some finite amount, say minus the charge on the electron, but if I'm outside of the electron, I get 0. Right? So the electron is a pretty small object, the charge density is 0 there, the charge density is basically infinite right on top of the electron, but if I include the electron in my region of integration, I'm going to get the charge on the electron every time. So what we want is kind of the equivalent of a three-dimensional delta function. And it turns out that it's not super hard to make such a function. So I'm going to claim, and we'll show, that if I take the Laplacian, and you remember that's derivative with respect to x squared, y squared, z squared, all added together, if I take the Laplacian of 1 over the distance from some fixed point, I claim this is going to be minus 4 pi times the delta function. And certainly we know that the Laplacian of this thing is usually 0, right? We showed that. So this thing certainly satisfies that first property of the delta function. It's almost always 0. If I do a volume integral of this quantity, what do I get? That's what we need to show. And I claim what I'm going to get is minus 4 pi, regardless of what's going on. Okay, so here's kind of the picture. Here's the origin, and here's this point r prime that I'm going to have some volume integral that is perhaps going to surround that. And I claim that no matter what size or shape I have for that volume, as long as it includes the point r prime, and therefore includes the delta function, I'm going to get minus 4 pi for my value. Okay, so that's what I need to prove. Right, once I've done that, then I will have shown that this thing is just the delta function. So the first thing to realize is I can change the shape of my region of integration pretty freely. So if instead of integrating over the black shape, let's say I cut it off and I change the volume of integration to be, the edge of the volume of integration to be that blue area. What's the difference between those two integrals? Well, I think it's clear that the difference between if I integrate all of this and I integrate all of the black, it's just going to be the integral of that region. And in this region, the Laplacian is zero. So obviously, this difference contributes exactly nothing to my cause. Because we proved that a few times ago. We did this calculation by hand and showed that it was zero. It's hard to say when we get zeros in the denominator, all bets were off. But as long as we were away from the zero in the denominator, that thing was zero. And certainly for this region, it's going to be that. So for my general region of integration, I'm going to push it around until it's a nice sphere that surrounds this point r prime. And then what I've got going for me is the integral theorem that we showed before, right? The integral of the divergence of any function that was equal to the surface integral around the boundary. And of course, the Laplacian, that's the divergence of the gradient of, in this case, 1 over r minus r prime. Okay, so I can convert my volume integral over the inside of this sphere into a surface integral around the boundary of that sphere. And of course, the normal is going to be the thing that's pointing right out. So this integral is then going to be the surface integral of just the gradient of 1 over r minus r prime. And you might remember that was minus r prime divided by the magnitude of r minus r prime cubed. So I need to dot that into the normal, and then I have the little area vector. So if you're in doubt about what the gradient of that function was, remember we showed that last time, again by direct calculation, that it was equal to that. Okay? So this integral is not going to be that hard to do, because for this whole sphere, the distance that we are from r prime is a constant. And this normal vector is in the same direction as r minus r prime. Now I want to make this into a unit vector, so I'm going to take this factor and divide it by that one to give me another unit vector. And I'm going to have left over the radius of that small sphere squared, the area. So unit vector dotted into unit vector, that's a constant, right? They are pointing in the same direction, so there's no difference that way. The a is a constant, so this is just going to be, oops. Okay, so I cheated a little bit and you didn't complain. That minus sign, right? So r minus r prime by itself is in the direction of this unit vector, but I do have that minus sign to go along for the ride. So I've got minus 1 over a squared, add up all of the area of that little sphere, and we know that the area of a sphere is 4 pi times its radius squared. So we've got minus 4 pi for our integral. Okay, so a three-dimensional example of the delta function is the Laplacian of 1 over r minus r prime. And sometimes, when we're more careful, we might write this as delta cubed just to remind us that it's three-dimensional. I don't know if I'll always remember to do that. Okay, so one-dimensional example of a delta function. Here's another example of a delta function. These things, as you'll see, are pretty useful in proofs in order to kind of rearrange things the way we want to. Okay, so in terms of our triangle, what we'd like to have is a way of getting from the electric field to the charge density that's causing it, and from the voltage to the charge density that's causing it. So how can we go about doing that? Okay, so what we've got for our electric field is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the little bit of charge that's at the source point r prime, dv prime, and then we've got the vector that points from that source to our observation point r. And even though this looks like a 1 over r cubed, it's really a 1 over r squared, pretty much exactly like what we would expect. And this whole quantity here, you remember, could be written as minus the gradient of 1 over r minus r prime. So let's take the divergence of this electric field. You might remember early on we said that if you tell me the divergence and the curl of something, I can tell you what the source is. So let's see what happens if we take the divergence of all of this. So what we've got then is the divergence of the gradient, that's the Laplacian. We got this minus, pesky minus sign to worry about. So we got minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up over all of the source charge. Now we've got the Laplacian of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime. And we've said, we've shown that this is minus 4 pi times the delta function. And we know if we said this before, maybe it's worth repeating. Let's do this in one dimension. So if we have the integral of f of x times delta of x minus some constant point. So this is putting the singularity at the point x equals a and integrate this up dx. This integrand is exactly the same as f of a times x minus the delta function. Right? If x isn't equal to a, then the whole thing is 0, and this whole thing is 0, so they agree there. And when x is equal to a, well, of course they're equal, right? Because I put in a. So this is a constant as far as the integration is concerned. So we're going to get f of a times the integral of the delta function. And we know that the area under a delta function is 1, so we get that. Okay, so generically, if we have a function and a delta function that has its singularity at the point A, and we integrate that up, what we get is the function evaluated at that point. Okay, and that's how it's going to work here, right? So here's the function that is playing the role of f of x. Here's the singular point. So what we're going to get then for the divergence of the electric field, so we have minus 4 pi epsilon naught going along for the ride. When we do this integration with this delta function, we're going to get minus 4 pi times the density where the singular point is, which is at the point r. And you can see the 4 pi's go away. So this is going to be just the charge density divided by epsilon naught. Okay, so this is a forever equation. This is one of four critical equations that are called Maxwell's equations. We've got another equation that is going to last for at least a month before we have corrections to it, and that's what the curl of the electric field is. So the curl of the electric field, that's the curl of minus the gradient of phi And if you just write that out, right, so we have I, J, K, derivative with respect to X, derivative with respect to Y, derivative with respect to Z, and then we have the X derivative of phi, the Y derivative of phi, the Z derivative of phi. If you just work that out, here we're going to have the derivative of Y, derivative of Z phi, and when we do it the other way, we're going to have the derivative of Z, derivative of Y phi. And those are the same things, right? Derivatives commute. So this is equal to 0. So I don't know if you stressed it in mechanics that path independence for a force vector goes along with the curl of that thing being 0, but it's true. Okay, so these are two Maxwell's equations. This one is good as long as things aren't changing in time. And we're not going to have things changing in time for a while. This one with the star is going to be just as true at the final as it is now. Okay. So let me do one other thing quickly. Remember, we also wanted to be able to get the charge density from the voltage. And that's easily enough done. We've shown that the divergence of the electric field is equal to the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And we know that the electric field is minus the gradient of phi. So if you just put those two things together, you get the Laplacian of phi is minus the charge density divided by epsilon naught. So that's called Poisson's equation. And I'm sure you all remember it from advanced physics lab where we had Poisson's equation occurring. What's going to be, incidentally, a particularly important case is usually the charge density is elsewhere. Usually we're interested in the voltage where there isn't charge, basically because that's where you can usually put your meters and equipment. So very frequently, we're going to be concerned with the equation that the Laplacian of phi is 0. Okay, so that's only good if we're not bumping up to charge. So kind of in a typical experiment, you know, we may have a box that is producing some voltage on the inside of it. So inside that box, we can apply Laplace's equation. So these are both famous dead French physicists. Okay, so I don't think you've seen any of these equations before in 200, basically because you hadn't had vector calculus yet. What you did have in 200 was a law that was called Gauss's law. And we probably make too big a deal out of Gauss's law. It's only useful in a handful of circumstances, but in those few circumstances, it gives us answers super fast. So that's why it played, I think, a big role in 200. And it'll play a non-trivial role, I guess, in this class too, just because, for the same reason, we can very quickly get what electric fields are. So I'm sure you all remember that Gauss's law told you that if you had a Gaussian surface, and a Gaussian surface is any imaginable surface, right? It's not something that is physically there usually. So some imaginary surface, closed surface that's surrounding something. And what Gauss's law said is if you take the surface integral of the electric field dotted into the normal times the little bit of area, what you got was the enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. Okay, so we can now prove Gauss's law pretty quickly. So if we, this form should remind you of Gauss's theorem that we talked about, namely that the divergence of the electric field integrated with respect to volume was the same thing as the electric field dotted into the normal dA. And we now know that the divergence of the electric field is the charge density divided by epsilon naught. Epsilon naught is a constant. It comes outside of the integral. The integral of the charge density times the volume is the total enclosed charge. Okay. So, Gauss's law. So I don't know. So typically, Gauss's law is only useful when this integral is, I mean, generally speaking, surface integrals are a real mess to evaluate. And about the only time they're not a big mess to evaluate is when this thing is a constant and you can pull it outside of the integral. And then what you're going to get is the electric field times the area. I should maybe give this thing a name. Sometimes it's called the electric flux. Okay, so kind of the 200 version of Gauss's law was the electric field times the area of some surrounding object was equal to the total enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. It's always true if you can actually do this surface integral, but I don't think we're ever going to do any cases where where this quantity isn't a constant. Those integrals are just too nasty to do kind of in general. So let's take a look at, you know, kind of the standard example from 200. So imagine that you've got a, and this is kind of the typical sort of example, I've got a sphere that has radius r and charge density rho, uniform charge density rho. And I want to find the electric field every place. So if I make a Gaussian surface that surrounds this charge and has some radius r, now by symmetry, if we just think about it, the electric field has to point right out. Well, why is that? Why couldn't the electric field, you know, have, for example, a small x component? Well, if I rotate that sphere 90 degrees, it's exactly the same problem. And so if the electric field had a little x component before, it should still have a little x component. But if I've rotated everything by 90 degrees, that x component has become a y component. So there's no possibility of this thing pointing any way except right out. And furthermore, all of these points are equivalent, right? They're all the same distance from the same object, right? So if I want to figure out what the electric field is there, I could just rotate that whole thing until it was at exactly the same point, and it has to have exactly the same value. So just from symmetry, we can see that the electric field has to just depend on our distance from the sphere, and it has to be in the radial direction. And of course, the normal is also in the radial direction. So when it comes time to evaluate this integral, the dot product is going to be 1. The thing only depends on distance. So this is going to be whatever distance I am from the sphere times the integral of the area. And we know that the surface area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. This thing is supposed to equal the enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. And of course, the enclosed charge is all of the charge, namely the volume of the sphere times the charge density. Okay? It's nice to have still call that Q because it's a pretty convenient quantity. So the electric field is exactly that given by Coulomb's law, except this isn't a point. It's actually a distributed object. So we have that charge divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r squared, right? So there's the epsilon naught, there's the r squared and the 4 pi, and everything up top is just the charge. Okay, so we could actually do this integral. It's kind of a mess, right? We did it once to find out what the electric field is, but here we kind of immediately got the answer. How about if we want the electric field inside this sphere? Well, if you think it through, everything is the same except the enclosed charge. So now the enclosed charge is just the charge that's inside the smaller Gaussian sphere. Same formula, 4/3 pi times the volume of that sphere, but the volume of that sphere is now 4 pi lowercase r cubed. So what we have then is the electric field times the surface area of that Gaussian surface has to be its enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. And you can see, you know, lots of things can cancel out if we want to. So the electric field depends linearly on distance from the center of that sphere. How about voltages? How can we get voltages? Well, remember, we can always get voltages by this general formula, right? Integrate out from the point of interest to ground the electric field dotted in dl. So if I wanted the voltage at this spot, ground is, of course, out there at infinity. I could integrate out those electric fields out to infinity. And that always works, but often there are kind of faster ways of doing it. Because we know, for example, that the electric field should be minus the gradient of phi. And everything is in the r direction, so this is going to be minus the derivative with respect to r of phi. And pretty frequently, you can just kind of do the antiderivative in your head. What has a minus derivative of 1 over r squared? Well, 1 over r, right? So phi is just going to be q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r. Okay, I can try the same trick here. What has minus derivative that is r? Well, 1 half r squared. But here I run into a little bit of a problem. Usually, we want the voltage to agree, right? So if I kind of plot these things out, so I'm plotting the voltage as a function of r. So what we've seen is that the voltage as a function of r is decreasing like 1 over r from the radius of the sphere. But this thing says that the voltage looks like that. It's minus 1 half r squared. And of course, what's going on here is that we can determine potential energy up to a constant, right? So I could have had a constant here, and it would just as much have that derivative as if I didn't have that constant. So I need to pick that constant so that it pushes this thing up so that we get a match when we're at the surface of the sphere. So let me comment, if I actually did this integral, it would automatically figure out what that constant is for me. But of course, I'd have to be integrating a different functional form when I'm inside the sphere compared to when I'm outside the sphere. So I don't know, your mileage may vary. I find it pretty useful to figure out what the antiderivative is and then add the constant and then kind of figure out what's going to work. So just to do that precisely, if I find out what the voltage is at the surface of the sphere according to this equation, it's going to be that constant minus the charge density divided by 6 epsilon naught times the r squared. If I figure out what the voltage is using this formula, I'm going to get q over 4 pi epsilon naught capital R. And you can see that this is one equation with one unknown, so I can calculate that constant just fine. Okay. So what are kind of the other cases that we can use Gauss's law for to calculate all of these sorts of nice things. Well, basically for each set of coordinate systems that we've got a highly symmetrical situation. So we've just done the case of where we have a uniform charge density for a sphere. So the other cases that things are going to work out pretty nicely for are in cylindrical coordinates and rectangular coordinates. So let's do rectangular coordinates. So I want things just to depend on one variable and be in rectangular coordinates. And if you figure out what that means I'm going to have an infinite plane of some charge density sigma. Now let's think about that charge as being positive, just so we can draw little arrows. We know that the electric field points away from positive charge. So kind of a priori, we're going to expect that the electric field, for example, is going to be going up, and it's going to be going down. Any relationship between these two electric fields, the one above and the one below? Is there any symmetry operation that says, for example, that they have to be equal but opposite? And the answer is yes. If we take this plane and we twist it 180 degrees, we're going to put the bottom on the top. And it's going to be exactly the same physical situation. So this electric field has to be exactly like that electric field, except switched in the opposite direction. So let's, whatever that electric field is, let's call it E. It can't depend on X and Y, right? Because if I'm on an infinite plane, this spot is the same as that spot, right? It's infinite in all directions either way. And it can't have an X or a Y component for the same reason about the sphere, right? If I take the physical situation and rotate it by 90 degrees, I'm in exactly the same spot. The electric field vector should have rotated when I rotated the object, but according to my formula, it has an X component. So can't be that way. So the electric field has to only be in the Z direction and it might potentially depend on Z. And it has to be the same top and bottom at the same altitude above the plane. Okay, so let me draw my charged plane in cross section and let's make a little Gaussian surface. Let's go exactly as much above the Gaussian surface as we went below the Gaussian surface. So remember that what we're supposed to integrate is the electric field dotted into the normal times a little bit of area. We have to do that for all of the surrounding pieces of this box. Oddly enough, these sorts of things are often called pill boxes. And I have a pill box. I could show you one, I guess. So on these vertical edges, the normal, of course, is pointing that way. And the electric field is perpendicular to those. So for these horizontal surfaces, E dot n is going to be 0. On the other hand, for the top and for the bottom, E dot that normal is going to be equal to basically the electric field, right? The angle between the electric field and the normal is 0, and the cosine of 0 is 1. So what we get here is the area on the top times the electric field on the top at some altitude z plus the area on the bottom times the electric field on the bottom at its altitude z. And we know that the area on the top is equal to the area on the bottom because these walls did go up exactly vertically. And we know that the electric field is the same on the top and the bottom. So this is all just twice the electric field at that altitude z times the area. How much charge is enclosed? Well, the charge is right here. And the charge is going to be the surface charge density times that area. And the surface integral is supposed to equal the total charge divided by epsilon naught. So you can see the areas cancel out. So the electric field at altitude z is equal to the charge density divided by 2 epsilon naught. And there's no z dependence, right? In the end, it didn't depend on z. So the electric field is the same every place. Incidentally, we could have come to that same conclusion by making a Gaussian surface that was hanging above the surface. That electric that Gaussian surface encloses no charge, and we're going to get a negative contribution from that electric field. We're going to get a positive contribution from that electric field. It has to add up to zero, so the electric field here has to be the same in magnitude as that electric field. Okay. So what is the electric potential that's going to produce that electric field? So electric fields always point downhill. They point to lower voltages. And the electric field is constant, so the antiderivative is just going to be z. So if you think about it, the electric field is going to be minus sigma over 2 epsilon naught, absolute value of z, right? It's downhill either way. So if I plot phi versus z, looks like that. Constant slope, constant derivative, constant electric field, and the electric field is pointing downhill on the top and the bottom. Okay. Say again. So I like the word voltage because I think it reminds you of what's really going on. It really is exactly the same thing that the voltmeter reaches. So I will try and use the word voltage all the time. But technically, it is the electric potential. Oh, you're saying that I said it wrong. Yeah, so recently I've been talking about the voltage. Here's the formula for the electric field. I'll have to erase that part on the tape so I'm perfectly correct. Okay, so we've done spheres, we've done rectangular coordinates. What's left? Well, so what we have then is cylindrical coordinates. So here what we're going to have then, if we look at the kind of exactly similar problem to the sphere, we've got an infinite rod. Right? So in the z direction, things are going to be infinite. And we have some charge density rho. This thing has some radius r. And we're supposed to figure out the electric field every place. And you did all these problems, I'm sure, in 200, and therefore I'm sure remember them. So if we make a Gaussian surface that is a coaxial cylinder, kind of like that. Oops, I should have done those dotted too, I guess. So first of all, what does symmetry tell us about the electric field? Well, the electric field can't have a z component, right? Because there's nothing special about going up compared to going down. Or said differently, I could flip the whole rod around and what was before up is now down. So the electric field has to point out just in the radial direction. It might depend, it will depend on our distance from that object. For this circle, the normal is in the z direction, whereas the electric field is in the r direction. So when it comes time to calculate the surface integral, we're going to get 0 for the top circle. We're going to get 0 for the bottom circle. The only place we're going to get contributions is for this cylindrical wall. There, the electric field and the normal are in the same direction. The electric field has to be the same every place on this circle. Why? Because if I rotate the physical object, I can take any particular point to that particular point. So the electric field is just going to depend on distance from the center of the from the rod, and it's going to be in the r direction. So when we do this integral, Now, just on the outer cylindrical surface, because that's the only place it's non-zero, this is a constant. This dot product is 1 because the R vector and the normal vector point in the same direction. So what we've got then is the electric field at that distance from the rod times the total area. And the area of such a piece is the circumference of the circle times the length of the piece that you've got. And we are promised that this is going to be the enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. How much enclosed charge is there? Well, it depends on how much volume we've got inside this Gaussian surface, right? All of this volume, that's where the charge is. And so what we're going to have is the charge density times that volume. And the volume of a right cylinder like this is the area of the bottom times the height divided by epsilon naught. Okay, so if we kind of put things together, what we've got is that the electric field times the surface area has to be equal to the charge density times the volume that's inside divided by epsilon naught. This is an R. Okay, so you can see that the L's are going to cancel. We can cancel off a pi, and the electric field then is going to be the charge density R squared divided by 2 epsilon naught R. So if that's the electric field, what's the voltage? What has a minus derivative that is 1 over R? Log, right? Yep. So the derivative of log is 1 over R. We have minus the derivative, so this thing is going to be all of these constants. The natural log of R. Now downstairs, they can write that without embarrassment. On any physics floor, we don't like to take the natural logarithm of things that have units. So, I don't know, what's going on here? Well, the basic problem is that the charge is extending out to infinity. So usually when we go to R equals infinity, we're infinitely far away from the charge and the voltage is going to be 0. But here, even when we're infinitely far away, there's still charge out there. So the voltage isn't going to go to 0 when we're infinitely far away. We had the same problem, incidentally, with the infinite plane, right? The voltage didn't go to 0 at infinity. The electric field didn't go to 0 at infinity. So there isn't a point, there isn't a natural point for ground. If I decide to make a point ground, then I can make something that works just by taking that, right? So that's just a constant difference from what I wrote before, and it has the property that the voltage when lowercase r is equal to uppercase r is equal to 0, because the logarithm of 1 is 0. Okay, but there's no way I can make the voltage at infinity go to 0, which is generally what we want to happen. We can't make it happen under these circumstances where we have a charge that also extends to infinity. Okay, so if you take a look at the homework, you'll see that I've done a good piece of the homework for you, but you can repeat it. You really have to be able to kind of run these arguments yourself in terms of symmetry and result instantaneously. You want to be able to do them without thought in order to kind of handle the sort of stuff that we have on exams. So kind of without thinking, you should be able to reproduce the stuff that we've already done. So, are we done? Are we done with this course, at least with the static part of this course, right? So, we've said that you tell me what the charge is, I can figure out what anything is. You tell me what any one of those three things are, I can answer the question of what the other things are. That, I don't know, sounds like at least a good start on answering all questions. The problem is that usually we don't know what the charge distribution is. That is to say, if you have an experiment, you can't put charge at this particular spot. What you can control is the voltage. And where the voltage is isn't necessarily where the charge is. So, and what we do is we don't know the voltage every place, we just know the voltage where we've attached wires. So we kind of have to come up to solve different sorts of problems where you tell me what the voltage is on some surface and I tell you what everything is every place else. So to kind of take a more or less standard example of this, let's say we have a spherical shell and I tell you what the voltage is on the surface of the shell. So pretty much everything we're going to be doing in this class is azimuthally symmetric, which I know from your homework most of you don't know the meaning of. So what azimuthally symmetric means is that things are the same all along circles of constant latitude. Okay, so I'm not going to write that the voltage depends on theta and phi, it just depends on theta. So it turns out that the techniques we're going to talk about, they work just fine even when we have dependence on both theta and phi, but they're as different as one-dimensional calculus is from two-dimensional calculus. That is to say, exactly the same, but at least twice as complicated. So we're going to limit ourselves to cases where we have some sort of symmetry so that we have the specified voltage just depending on one parameter. So equivalently, when we're talking about cylindrical coordinates, we're going to be talking about voltage that vary around the surface of the cylinder and don't depend on z, for example. And once again, we could handle the more general case, except it becomes increasingly nasty. Same thing in rectangular coordinates. We're going to be concerned where we specify the voltage, say, along the screen, and we're interested in the voltage every place else. So the common feature of what we've been talking about is that the voltage is confined to a pretty limited region of space, right? So this might be some sort of copper shell that we've put the voltage on, but I'm thinking that the charge density is, I don't know what the charge density is any place, except I know that it's zero any place that's offside that shell. And that means, of course, that the voltage has to satisfy Laplace's equation every place except maybe inside, maybe literally on that shell. So what we're going to want to do then is to figure out how to solve Laplace's equation in all of these different coordinate systems. Now let's start with about the simplest possible case, and that's going to be in rectangular coordinates. So if we think about the following problem, let's not worry about the z direction. So this is going to be some gutter that extends to plus or minus z all at once. And mostly I have things that just depend on x and y. And what we know is that inside of this region, we have to satisfy Laplace's equation, which is pretty simple, right? It says that two derivatives with respect to x of phi plus two derivatives with respect to y of phi, and nothing in terms of z because things are constant in terms of z, those things all have to add up to zero. Okay. So this is an equation that I think you're just starting to take a look at in your Fourier series course. in that it's a partial differential equation. Right? So you took a course on solving ordinary differential equations. Here we've got a partial differential equation. How are we going to go about solving it? And their partial differential equations are way more complicated to solve than ordinary differential equations. And we're going to start by making a huge, seemingly stupid approximation. Right, so I'm going to look at the case where my voltage, which in general depends on x and y, factors. So it's some function of x times some function of y. It's pretty unusual for functions to have that property, right? So for example, x squared plus y squared can't be written as the product of something in x times the product of something in y. Very, very few functions, basically no functions, are going to automatically factor. And so real good question is, are we solving nothing, right? Solving nearly nothing. And the answer is going to better turn out to be no, right? We actually are getting something useful out of this. And so what's going to turn out to be the case is while pretty much no function can be written as the product like that, lots of functions, approximately speaking all functions, can be written as a sum of terms like that. So our plan is to take some sort of superposition, a sum out of lots of these various terms. And I claim that for pretty much any old function, we'll be able to write it as a sum of these sorts of product terms. So, I don't know, with that introduction, let's think about, well, let's do that problem first and at least see how it works and come back. But let me at least write up what is going to be an important fact, Fourier's trick. Fourier's trick is going to be, and I'm just going to give you the words now, Fourier's trick is going to be an important tool we have to actually figure out what these expansion coefficients are for any old function that we might want to have. And it's a pretty marvelous trick. People, when Fourier wrote this, people pretty much didn't believe him. He's another one of these famous French physicists. All about the same time, approximately around Napoleon. Okay, so let's go back to what we were going to do. So we said that we were going to look for the second derivative of x with respect to phi plus the second derivative of y with respect to phi being 0, with the particularization that phi was the product of a function of x and a product of y. And of course, what makes that simple is if I'm taking derivatives of that with respect to x, the y piece is just going to come out. And when I'm taking derivatives of that with respect to y, the x piece is going to come out. So this pretty much immediately is y, two derivatives of x, plus x, two derivatives with respect to y. And all of that is supposed to be 0. So if I do the usual thing, put all the stuff on one side of the equation, the other stuff on the other side of the equation, so I'm going to have x, y double prime is minus y, x double prime. And let me divide through now by the product of x times y. So then I'm going to get y double prime divided by y has to be equal to minus x double prime divided by x. There's a real important thing that is hidden in this equation that I think isn't obvious to start with. And that is, I'm guaranteed that this is a constant. And of course, what constant means is it doesn't depend on x or y. Why is that? So if I start at some point and I decide to change y, let me change y using this side of the formula. It doesn't change whatever the value is, right? Because this side just depends on x. So if I start at that same point and I decide to change the x value, let me do it by evaluating this side of the formula. And according to that, it doesn't depend on x. So if it doesn't depend on y and it doesn't depend on x, it doesn't depend on anything. It has to be a constant. So, I don't know, let me call this constant what should I call it? I'm going to call it minus something for special reasons in the future. Let me call it minus m squared. So now I have two differential equations, right? I have ordinary differential equations. I have y double prime is equal to minus m squared y. And you can maybe see why I chose to name that constant the way I did, right? That has solution. That y is equal to sine or cosine, take your pick. I'm going to take sine of my. And I've got the other differential equation, which is x double prime is equal to plus m squared x. And that, of course, has solutions that are x equals e to the plus or minus mx. It's kind of helpful to write things in a similar fashion. So here we have sine and cosine, and here we have exponentials. Any relationship between exponentials and sines and cosines? People who have said complex variables say yes. So, Euler, I'm not sure whether to call Euler a physicist or a mathematician. A lot of these guys were doing pretty much both. So Euler has this real surprising statement that e to a complex exponential is equal to cosine theta plus I sine theta. All right, so why should you believe that? And I never make mistakes, at least when I have an eraser. Well, yeah, and I have the ability to backspace and delete. So how can we prove this relationship? Kind of surprising. So let me comment for maybe those that don't know that I is the square root of minus one, and pretty commonly engineers like to call that J because they're using I for current. So you should be handy with seeing either of those notations. So probably the fastest proof of this, of course, it requires you to remember your Taylor series expansions. So who all remembers the Taylor series expansions for all of these things? Who remembers Taylor series expansions? Me? No one else? So let me write down Taylor so you can tattoo it appropriately. So if we have a general function at x naught plus delta x, it's approximately equal to f of x naught plus the derivative evaluated at x naught times delta x plus 1 over 2 factorial the second derivative of that function evaluated at x naught times delta x squared plus 1 over 3 factorial off to the races. So the exponential function is special because its derivative is itself. And if I evaluate it at 0, So I'm going to make x naught 0. I'm going to get 1. So this is just going to be 1 plus x plus 1 over 2 factorial x squared plus 1 over 3 factorial x cubed all the way along. Now, if we think about cosine theta, the derivative of cosine theta is minus sine. Derivative of sine theta is going to be cosine. So we're going to go around in a circle, and we're going to have alternating sines. So if you think about what that means, cosine of x starts at 1. It doesn't have this term because the derivative of cosine, which is sine, evaluated at 0, is 0. And then we get a minus sine. We don't have this term because the sine is going to be 0. And then we have plus 1 over 4 factorial x to the 4th. And it works very similarly for sine, except now we have these terms like that. And you can see that these things kind of go together pretty well. Right? If I put in I theta for x, I'm going to get minus x squared, right? Because I squared is minus 1. And I'm going to get plus x to the 4th because I to the 4th is minus 1 squared is plus 1. So I'm going to get exactly these terms for the even terms. For the odd terms, I'm going to get I theta. I'm going to here have I cubed. You can change that thing to that minus to plus 1, and I'm going to have just a factor of I. So if you work that out, e to the I theta is exactly equal to cosine theta plus I sine theta. And contrary-wise, we can rewrite this as, for example, cosine theta is equal to e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta divided by 2. Okay, so we can make things that are like exponentials with just leaving out the i's. So these are the so-called hypergeometric functions, hyperbolic functions, excuse me. And I bet you've seen them before, and you know that you have buttons on them on your calculator. So they must be pretty well known. And there are big correspondence between these hyperbolic functions and the corresponding trigonometric functions. So I'll mention, for example, that cosine squared plus sine squared is equal to 1. And it turns out that cosh, that's how you pronounce it, cosh squared minus sinh squared is equal to 1. So pretty much any formula that you know about for trigonometric functions, including things like double angles, half angles, all that sort of stuff, there's a version of that equation that is true for cosh and sinh if you just put in the i's and the minus signs in the appropriate places. Okay, so what does all of that matter? Well, I'm going to choose as my functions, instead of e to the plus minus mx, I'm going to choose cosh mx and sinh mx. And maybe one other property that I should remind you of immediately is, just like the sine of 0 is 0, the sinh of 0 is 0. And just like the cosine of 1 is 1, excuse me, the cosine of 0 is 1, the cosh of 0 is 1. So if we were to make plots of cosh, it looks kind of like that, going exponentially big. If we were to make a plot of sinh, it would look kind of like that. When people get lazy, they abbreviate cosh down to ch and sinh down to sh. Okay, so this is solving Laplace's equation in two rectangular coordinates, and what we found is solutions. And the claim is, by taking sums of those solutions, I can make anything I want, particularly once I've learned out what Fourier's trick is. Okay, so it's still 3 o'clock, so we still have 90 minutes to talk. Any questions?